Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. Jazz is a music that underwent many stylistic changes in its early decades, from the swing of the 1930s and the bebop of the 1940s to the hard bop of the 1950s, the free jazz of the 1960s, and the fusion of the 1970s. In his book, Why Jazz Happened, JazzWax blogger and Wall Street Journal music writer Mark Myers takes a look at some of the social, cultural, and other non-musical forces and events that helped shape the evolving sound of jazz. And he'll be joining me for the next hour to talk about those influences. It's Why Jazz Happened with Mark Myers, coming up next on Nightlights.
Thank you.
trumpeter Miles Davis doing his tune Half Nelson, with John Coltrane on tenor sax, Red Garland on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. That comes from the 1956 prestige album Workin'. The recorded history of jazz begins in 1917 when the original Dixieland Jazz Band checked into a New York studio to make a record of the songs Livery Stable Blues and Dixie Jazz Band One Step. In the decades that followed, jazz underwent many stylistic changes during a period that also saw changes in the way Americans lived, worked, and relaxed. JazzWax blogger and Wall Street Journal music writer Mark Myers takes a look at some of the forces that helped shape the evolving sound of jazz in his book, Why Jazz Happened.
What I found is most fascinating about jazz history are those things that have nothing to do with jazz. In other words, the music itself we love, and the music itself is fascinating, and the musicians are geniuses. I mean, it's staggering how great the music and the musicians are. But the reason, you know, that jazz changes so often during the years turns out to have something to do with these external forces that either create opportunities for jazz musicians along the way to create new forms, or pressures that force them to change for commercial reasons.
For Myers, the era of jazz that's most captivating transpired between the early 1940s and the early 1970s.
After 1942, after a series of non-jazz events that take place, jazz becomes highly individualistic. You've got the solo, you've got the musician in charge, you've got different forms of music that are driven by the musician, not commercial interests. And those next 30 years, to me, are the three golden decades of jazz, the real pure, beautiful, individualistic protests, spiritual, you know, all the great human emotions are captured in that 30 years. And then from about 1972 on, jazz, to me, sort of plateaus. It's a looking back art form. It's a repertory art form that is sort of celebrating its own past. But that past is very often 1942 through 72.
Myers' social context approach to understanding jazz history isn't completely new. It could be viewed as a more accessible, less jargonistic version of what's often called new jazz studies. But it's still a way of looking at jazz history that's sometimes frowned upon by older jazz critics.
I'm not sure that there's been resistance to it. I think it's more a product of many people not taking those things and factoring them in. In other words, I think most people in the past who have written about jazz and written about jazz beautifully have either been newspapermen, journalists, magazine writers, in some cases novelists, in other cases musicians themselves. I don't know that there's that many people who have been writing about jazz who actually have sort of studied the discipline of history itself. In other words, a lot of people call themselves jazz historians simply because they look back in the past or collect old records, but I don't know how many jazz writers have actually have degrees in history, so to speak. So most people who study history tend to go on to teach. They go on to a PhD, and they go on to teach about Lincoln or the Civil War or World War II or, you know, the rise of the Industrial Revolution or whatever their specialty is. But I don't know that there are too many people who study history and then go on to sort of look at jazz or write about jazz. So I think this is different from that perspective.
In his book, Myers documents the impact that the musician-imposed recording band of the early 1940s had on jazz, and the way in which bebop, which began as a highly modernistic New York City-based music, gained a mainstream foothold in America, partly through the medium of radio.
After the war, with the slow and then steady rise of television in the late 40s, the specter of television, the FCC decides that that all of these independent radio stations that are applying for licenses, which they wouldn't grant during the war, they're suddenly handing radio licenses out hand over fist to independent stations all over the country, especially in markets where there is no television. In other words, to unify the country and to set up a national system of communication through radio and television, independent radio stations start getting licenses. And these individual stations and existing stations start to be approved for higher frequencies, greater pushing out of their signals. And that's why Creed, all the way down in Virginia at night, over the mountains, he's able to hear these powerful New York stations, which include Symphony Sid and Freddie Robbins and other disc jockeys. But you're suddenly able to hear the New York signals
DJs such as Symphony Sid Torin gave a colorful and lively narration of the bebop scene that often captivated listeners.
It's Runyon-esque, and it feeds into the mystique, the nocturnal mystique of jazz, which also changes in the 40s. I mean, jazz goes, you know, becomes this nocturnal, neon sign, rainy night sort of music that it hadn't been before. It takes on this aura.
And so once again, ladies and gentlemen, we take our WMCA microphones right down to the Royal Roots, our Friday night, Saturday morning edition of the all-night, all-frantic one, bringing a lot of the gone things here at the Metropolitan Opera House, the original house that Bob built on Broadway between 47th and 48th Streets, bringing you the gonest and modern progressive music. The new sounds, the Royal Roots, ladies and gentlemen, every night, seven nights and mornings a week from 9:30 till 4 in the morning, you can sit back and relax and dig the gonest. Talking about the Gunners, let's bring him on with a wonderful hand, Mr. Bop himself, Charlie Parker and the All-Stars. Charlie Parker, that's Charlie Parker, Max Roach, Al Haig, Tommy Potter, and Kenny Durham. And to start things jumping, one of the dial signs that you all ask for all the time, here's the bird to do Scrapple from the Apple.
Charlie Parker, broadcasting live from the Royal Roost in New York City in 1949, introduced by jazz DJ Symphony Sid Torin. Another development in the late 1940s that impacted jazz was the GI Bill, passed by Congress near the end of World War II.
The GI Bill, in effect, it's passed in June of 44, but what the GI Bill does, that has an impact on jazz is twofold. One is it allows musicians to go returning veterans who are musicians, it allows them to go back, it allows them to go to school for free. It allows them to go to college for free. And musicians who went to college for free underwent formal training. They went to the Manhattan School of Music, they went to Juilliard, they went to all kind, you know, North Texas State, they went to a whole host of musical programs throughout the country. And in many cases, they were formal. They learned classical, modern classical music in these settings, not jazz. And many of them, saxophone wasn't even offered. All saxophonists had, they all had to sort of learn clarinet in classical form in these schools. So on the one hand, you've got free education for musicians in the 40s, but even equally important was low-cost, 0% loan on homes. So with the rise of the suburbs, with the rise of homes, with the rise of the suburbs and millions of new houses expanding around cities, all of these houses had phonographs. And phonographs meant LPs, and LPs meant jazz, pop, classical, all kinds of music. So music blossoms and blooms as a result of the GI Bill due to more musicians coming out of music school who are more highly trained, and also home ownership, which meant greater use of phonographs and bigger demand for record sales. Record sales explode in the 1950s once the LP is adapted.
Thank you.
Miles Davis's Israel from Birth of the Cool and Dave Brubeck's Playland at the Beach from the Dave Brubeck Octet, two records that exemplify the sophisticated, more academic and classical-influenced strain of jazz that emerged in the years following the end of World War II. Another significant change that Mark Myers examines in his book was the record label's introduction of the long player album format.
To reach the home market, for it to be viable, they had to come up with something that wouldn't force people every 3 minutes to get out of their chair at home and turn this over. It's one thing if the record ends on the jukebox and somebody has to put more nickels in, but to have to constantly get up from your chair and turn it over, it just wasn't tenable. So what they realized is we've got to come up with a format that runs longer and allows people to enjoy the music at home. Then they'll buy the records. They'll buy these new things called LP. So Columbia introduces the LP. And it holds 22 and a half minutes per side on the 12-inch and about 15 minutes on the 10-inch. 10-inch for pop music, 12-inch for classical, because that's where the money was. But what happens, you know, and that's possible only because of recording tape, by the way. The system to record records up until this point is like a Frankenstein's laboratory of chemical baths and metal parts, and it's just absurd to see what it took to make a record back then. Once you had tape, the cost dropped dramatically. The 10-inch LP completely revolutionizes pop and jazz early on because suddenly musicians have more real estate on sides of records to play longer solos. And record companies begin encouraging these musicians to take longer solos because it eats up more time and they won't have to pay as many copyrights to Tin Pan Alley composers who basically supply jazz with the music that was being jazzed up during this period. So it was win-win for everyone involved.
saxophonist Zoot Sims with an extended solo on Zoot Swings the Blues, recorded in 1951. I'll have more of my interview with Mark Myers in just a few moments. You can hear many previous Nightlights programs and new playlists on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more. Located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Why Jazz Happened with special guest Mark Myers on Nightlights. Talking with Jazz Wax blogger and Wall Street Journal music writer Mark Myers on this edition of Nightlights about his book Why Jazz Happened, which examines some of the social, economic, and cultural forces that helped influence the sound of jazz in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. One style that emerged in the early years of the 1950s was West Coast jazz, which Myers says strongly reflected the circumstances in which it was recorded.
West Coast jazz has, you know, for the most part, I mean, for lack of a better way to put it, has a more laid-back contrapuntal sound. It's less heavy on the rhythm section and more intricate in the horns. And, you know, as I was listening to the music, a lot of it, and as it evolves, it just has this yawning sensibility, this laid-back, surfy sound. And I sort of wanted to get a sense of how that evolved outside of the musicians, the brilliant musicians who created it. What allowed for this to happen? And the more musicians I interviewed who were out there creating this music, the more I interviewed them, the more I realized that a large part of that sound had a lot to do with its environment out there. That unlike New York, which was compressed in subways and tenements and walk-ups and tight, you know, city pressure, the West Coast was expansionist. It you know, it had the ocean along its coast. It had long sunsets. The weather was great. There were cars. There were highways. There was cheap home ownership, strip malls. So it's a completely different environment in which this music develops. And as it develops out there, you know, these musicians really were conscious of the bliss that they experienced.
Thank you.
Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker's West Coast Pianoless Quartet performing Nights at the Turntable in 1952, a musical cornerstone of the emerging West Coast jazz style. On the East Coast, another jazz style began to emerge, helped into the limelight by producer and Blue Note Records co-owner Alfred Lion. The style, drawing on hard-driven, catchy riffs and beats, was dubbed hard bop.
The problem is that bebop has so saturated the marketplace, and jazz classical really isn't catching on. You know, it's not catching on in a big way, but West Coast jazz is going great guns. I mean, the Jerry Mulligan Quartet, you know, all the West Coast jazz is just taking off. And the East Coast realizes they've got to come up with something. The other big problem for East Coast jazz was the rise of R&B, the big steady beat. It's suddenly dance music, and jazz really can't compete any longer because they're not in the dance music business. But what Lion does, which is brilliant, is he realizes that by combining the energy and the steadiness of R&B with the horn-centric front line of West Coast jazz, that something new can be done here, that it might be interesting. So, of course, you know, Lou Donaldson and Clifford Brown and Art Blakey record in 1952-53. He catches, you know, Alfred Lion catches onto something at Blue Note, and, you know, what you see is this cookie-cutter model that Lion develops, where records are pretty much done the same way. You know, record after record after record is done the same way, with this winning formula of a few standards and a bunch of originals by the leader of the date, and they just repeat this formula with great success. So Blue Note just breaks the entire ice when it comes to hard bop, and other labels in New York like Savoy and Prestige and others follow suit.
We'll be right back.
Horace Silver and the Jazz Messengers in 1954 during Silver's tune Room 608. There were other new currents emerging as the 1950s went on, connected to the civil rights movement and musicians' increased willingness to bring their political and religious beliefs more directly into the music that they made.
By the late 1950s, spiritual jazz, which comes, you know, from what I'm talking about now, becomes protest jazz, where you've got Charles Mingus's Fables of Faubus. You've got all kinds of music that is looking to utopias elsewhere, in Africa, the Far East, the Caribbean, where things are more tolerated, where art is more tolerated, where people are, you know, the black artist is more tolerated. And through this period, you see the rise of individualistic statements, protests, spiritual statements. And that's what jazz becomes in the late 1950s. It's a repository of this sentiment of unfairness, expression of an unjust society that refuses to change. And this is how the jazz movement is contributing to the civil rights movement. We'll be right back.
Saxophonist Sonny Rollins doing his tune Erigen, Nigeria spelled backwards, in 1954. Rollins' nod to the growing African independence movements and the interest the jazz musicians were beginning to take in Africa. In his book Why Jazz Happened, Mark Myers also examines the free jazz movement that garnered a great deal of attention in the 1960s, but he does so primarily through the prism of one group, Chicago's AACM, or Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians.
My book, as you know, it focuses on, you know, the fascination for me is the changing jazz styles. So the premise for me was, okay, if you look at the major jazz styles that occur between 1942 and 1972, there's a chronology. It starts with bebop and ends with fusion. But along that timeline, between 1965 and probably into the early 70s, you know, which is sort of when, by then, the AACM is sort of petered out in terms of its influence and power, that there's this new form, this new style that emerges in Chicago in this nucleus called the AACM. Free jazz, you know, didn't really focus. It wasn't really a part of my book as a specific form and a specific movement, simply because it comes from so many different directions and has so many exponents. You know, what is free jazz? Is it Ornette Coleman? Is it the Miles Davis group? Does it happen before? What about Lenny Tristano? So, you know, it's very hard to pin down this moving thread through jazz known as free jazz. But the AACM rises, and why does it rise in Chicago? Why doesn't the same avant-garde style evolve at the same time in Los Angeles or New York or Miami or Detroit? Why in Chicago? And that's, to me, what the major question was. You know, why does it happen in that city, and then why does it stay coherent and cohesive in that city? Other cities had tried this. They tried to come up with these nonprofit groups where everybody was supporting each other to do their own thing, but they all failed except for the AACM, and that's what captivated me. Art Ensemble of Chicago, which grew out of the AACM, doing number 2, quartet version, recorded in 1967. While the AACM explored non-commercial forms of jazz, other artists found themselves responding to the exploding popularity of rock in the 1960s. For the mainstream companies, which depend on record sales and radio airplay and a certain combination of things to make money, at this point, a number of them are public and they have shareholders, you know, what you've got there is they need to find a way to stay in touch with what's going on, to capitalize on that. And what happens is a number of these jazz artists and jazz producers and labels, they figure out ways to jazz up transistor radio hits in the 60s, whether it's the Beatles or the Association. But whatever they do, they you can't beat them, you join them. But it you know, some of it's bad, a lot of it's actually quite good. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find too many jazz fans who would put down Wes Montgomery's albums for Creed Taylor that get at this jazz modern feel, where they're taking Going Out of My Head and giving that a jazz spin. I mean, that's jazz. It's just that jazz was using, instead of going back to Cole Porter and Irving Berlin, it was using modern singer-songwriters as a basis for what they were doing, and quite a bit of it is quite good.
Wes Montgomery performing his version of the pop rock hit Going Out of My Head in 1965. Other jazz musicians, particularly those who were younger, took a different path in responding to rock as the 1960s came to an end.
You know, David, there's always much talk about Dylan Goes Electric in 1965 at the Newport Folk Festival, but jazz went electric as well. And what happens in the mid-60s is that as the electric guitar and the electric bass and the organ and the electric piano become more prominent in rock groups in the 60s, especially in San Francisco, jazz artists suddenly realize that, you know, if they want to start to attract the large crowds that rock is starting to attract at this period, with the rise of the rock festival after 1966, that they're going to have to do more. They're going to have to do something to make their instruments sound louder, because you can't fill too many seats if nobody can hear what you're doing. And in my book, you know, Ron Carter talks about not being playing, but being somewhat downcast that because his instrument wasn't mic'd well yet, that audiences beyond the third row couldn't really hear what he was doing. The rest of the group could, but the rest of the group couldn't. So, but by the late 60s, you've got Gary Burton recording Duster with Larry Coryell and Roy Haynes, and I mean, there you have this fusion of forms. You have this fusion of rock and jazz, primarily because a lot of these guys are young. They're buying Sgt. Pepper, and they're watching their generation go off to listen to rock artists by the hundreds of thousands. You know, look at Woodstock, 500,000 people. So a lot of these young jazz guys are trying to find a way to connect with their generation with music that they actually like, but not giving up jazz. So, you know, you've got Tony Williams' Emergency, you've got Miles Davis in 1969 with Bitches Brew, Freddie Hubbard, of course, you know, with Red Clay, Weather Report, John McLaughlin, Larry Coryell. I mean, all of these guys are finding a way to merge not just rock, but electronic and volume. the late 60s is about electronic instruments and cranking up the volume, and you can only do that if you got electronic instruments, and you can only do that if you're willing to accept it. Remember, jazz, throughout its history, right up until 1969, roughly, is an acoustic instrument, and those who strayed, you know, took a ton of criticism, just as folk did, but it's not until that late period where Miles Davis embraces electronic music, everyone else begins to do it, and that's when you see in the early 70s, you see Weather Report and Return to Forever and other groups that find a way to unite the psychedelia of San Francisco with electronic music and light shows so that when they go into arenas or smaller portions of arenas that are set aside for, you know, smaller audiences, that they're able to actually, you know, push out into the audience the power of what they're putting forward.
Lifetime in 1969, performing Emergency. For Why Jazz Happened author Mark Myers, the biggest reward in writing his social context history of mid-20th century jazz came from coming to certain realizations with the musicians themselves as he interviewed them about their experiences in one of jazz's most vital and fast-changing eras.
Many of the things that I was thinking about in doing my research never dawned on these musicians. I mean, they lived through this period, but they never, you know, like, for instance, you know, when I interviewed George Avakian, the producer at Columbia from the beginning in the pop and jazz record area of the company, he had never put together the fact that the pending recording ban of 1948 had accelerated Columbia's development of the LP. And it's not until we had our conversation and he started adding pieces and I started adding pieces from my research that we realized what had been taking place external to jazz. Or that, you know, when I spoke with Billy Taylor about the first recording ban and the rise of bebop, you know, it was sort of remarkable to him because he had never added two and two and come up with that because he was inside the music. So in each case, whether I was interviewing Sonny Rollins or Creed Taylor, no matter who it was, the external research, which had been so foreign to these guys and would naturally be foreign to them because they're focused on what they have to do. They're focused on creating art. They're not worried about all the other factors taking place. That's a historian's job. But when you start adding all this stuff up, I think all of the people, all of the legends that I interviewed for the book, you know, had this aha moment, this, wow, gosh, I never really looked at it that way. And that's when I realized I was onto something special, when the musicians themselves were having a revelation at the same time and confirming what I believed and also adding to the pieces of the puzzle that were missing.
Thanks for tuning in this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Mark Myers. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, offering new and used music, DVDs, turntables, and more. Located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. You can listen to previous Nightlights programs and view playlists on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.